Good afternoon, everybody. I'd like to call Senate State Affairs Committee to order. Today is Tuesday, April 2nd, 2019. Let the record reflect time is 3:34 p.m. Today we have President Senator Reinbold, Senator Baczycki, Senator Kawasaki, myself, Chair Schauer. I am told that Senator Coghill will show up a little bit later. He had another meeting taking place. I'd like to remind everybody to go ahead and please turn off or silence your cell phones. Our staff assisting us, as always, we have Carrie on the front side. We've got Taylor behind us today in the LAO. Two items on today's agenda, and that's going to be to consider the governor's appointees to various boards and commissions, as well as public testimony for the same. And then, as time allows, we'll bring back up SJR 5, Constitutional Amendment, Permanent Fund, and Dividend from Rules by Request of the Governor. Now we're going to begin with considering the governor's appointees to various boards and commissions. The order in which we'll go through the appointees will be the Police Standards Council, Chief Administrative Law Judge, the Public Offices Commission, and the Parole Board. After opening remarks and questions from the committee members, we will open public testimony for each of those in order and anyone online or in the room that might want to testify. This time we're going to go ahead and get started. We have the first one coming up is going to be Joseph White, Chief of Police, aka Standards Council from Ketchikan. Mr. White, can you hear us?
Yes, I can.
All right, sir. Go ahead with your personal testimony. Why do you want to be, and why are you the right person for the Police Standards Council?
Okay. Well, I want to thank the committee, first of all, for giving me the opportunity to testify in front of you today. I do believe that I am a good qualified candidate for the Alaska Police Standards Council Board. I know you have my resume, but just a real brief background on me. I was born and raised in Ketchikan, Alaska. I attended college in Fairbanks and Anchorage, graduated from Anchorage in 92. I started my law enforcement career in Ketchikan in 1996 with the Ketchikan Police Department. Worked my way up from patrol officer to lieutenant, patrol officer to corporal to sergeant, lieutenant, and then chief. I took over the chief's position in 2017. In that time, I've been a school resource officer, an arson investigator, a field training officer. Most of the positions within the department I've come in contact with at one point in time. 2017, I attended the FBI National Academy, 2013, I'm sorry, at which time I primarily focused on leadership, ethics, changing the culture, things of that nature in the studies I did there. When it comes to the Alaska Police Standards Council Board, I believe that the two primary functions that I see the board holds is maintaining high standards for our officers in Alaska, law enforcement, corrections, probation, and assisting with training of those officers in the state. I think they kind of go hand in hand. When you have highly trained officers, you tend to have less liability issues on the backside. So I firmly believe that the training aspect is huge for officers in the state. And then with the standards part, if we're not keeping our officers to high standards, our communities suffer, our citizens suffer, our municipalities, our cities, and our state suffers. So I think that finding the right people and keeping the right people in these positions is crucial. And I think the board has a real strong part in that throughout the state. I think that the standards they set kind of guide all of Alaska law enforcement in reaching those standards. The things I bring to the board specifically is within my almost 23 years of law enforcement experience here, I've been involved in multiple disciplinary actions leading from counseling sessions all the way up to termination. I believe in progressive discipline and hearing both sides of the story, listening to the issues. Most of the time it's not just one person making his decision, so I do believe in a strong team atmosphere when we're attacking some of these things. And at the end of the day, people are looking to be treated fair and consistently, which that's what we do here at our department, and I think that's what this board does. I've been on three meetings now, and I do believe that everybody involved takes the time to listen to all sides of the issues. It seems fair and consistent every time, and I believe that the work the board does is crucial to law enforcement in Alaska. So that's kind of what I had to present today.
Okay, thank you for that testimony. Go ahead and open it up at this time to the committee members and see what questions they might have. Senator Kawasaki.
Thank you. Just a brief question. Thanks for participating, and thank you for your service to the folks in Ketchikan. Just a really brief question. You have 30 years of experience under your belt. Recruitment is a big issue across definitely across Alaska. We've heard about that at various different junctures, different departments. Why do you think, just your expertise, why do you think that recruitment is such a big issue for law enforcement these days?
Well, I think there's a lot of issues going on with that, and we were just talking. I think last year alone we hired either 6 or 7 officers. I'd have to recount. And within 2 years, we're probably going to lose another 4 to 5 due to retirement age guys. And it's really tough to get people to get qualified applicants to even put their names in the selection process. I think that the retirement system has had some effect on that. The tier system that we're now in, I think, probably discourages some people from coming into it. I think compensation in a lot of the places in Alaska have not kept up with down south. And I think overall, I think that there's been kind of the negativity associated with law enforcement, especially coming from down south and in bigger cities, has had an influence on the whole profession as a whole. And so... And of course, in Ketchikan, we're not remote. When you look at Alaska, I mean, we're an hour and a half from Seattle, but we are an island in Alaska, and so I think that it's tough to kind of get people interested in our department. In the past, I think we had at one point maybe 75-80% of our officers were local kids that had come up through the school system here, went through high school here, and we're not seeing that so much anymore. You know, we're really fortunate when we get a local applicant. We're very excited, and we take all the steps we can to cultivate those because we get better return on our investment. But at this point, I honestly got to tell you, we've kind of changed our recruiting philosophy from looking for 20-year officers to, you know, if we can get a 5-year officer, we're extremely happy at this point. So I think that the world has changed, the technology has changed, the workforce has changed, and unfortunately, I think the police profession has maybe kind of slid down the scale of preferred professions to go into.
Thank you.
Good. Senator Ramble.
Thank you. Your resume is impressive, and so thank you for being willing to serve. You've definitely got some really, really good, even on the federal with that FBI stuff. I thought that was really cool that you went there and did some research on issues that really seriously, like sexual assault, that are impacting Alaskans. And in regards to what Senator Kawasaki, I understand, you know, we're in fiscal times and everybody wants a nice retirement package. The private sector just has to suck it up and deal with it. And I think me and many others are on tier 4. So I know that's an issue that has to probably be tabled right now in the multi-billion-dollar deficits. But what my question to you is a lot of times when you look at the research with why people leave their job, it's because of morale issues. And I can tell you I've talked to dozens of police officers, and they are extraordinarily discouraged with SB 91. So I want to ask you if you think that the passage of SB 91, soft on crime, emboldening of criminals, has had an impact on the law enforcement.
Thank you. That was a great question. I think it has had an impact. I think that we see some officers do get discouraged with the system and how it's been going. I don't know if we have specific people in my department that have left because of that. And in all fairness, you said people leave for multiple reasons, and they do. And a lot of times it's not just the retirement system. They can make a little more money here, better hours here, less stress here. So there's a lot of reasons people have left our department. I would never try to say it was this, over one thing, over another thing. So there's multiple issues. But I think that as far as SB 91, when we were kind of going through the beginning of that and still through some of this, we do have some offenders down here who are quite brazen, and they know the system. And it does get frustrating. I do hear it from our line officers quite a bit. And I know we're making steps to correct some of these issues, and that's going a long ways. And so we're trying to see the big picture and the end of this and where we're going to end up down the road. But as far as guys going on doing their job every day, they still do. It just makes it a little more difficult on us to provide a good service to our community where we can keep them safe, their property, their persons, with some of these repeat people going out there and victimizing over and over again.
Senator.
Senator Rambo, follow-up?
Okay, so with that, yeah, because I can tell you that there's immense morale issues amongst the APD because of SB 91. They just feel like, you know, before they even get their report, and even the troopers have told me this, that before they even get the ink is dry on the report, the guy or gal is back out reoffending. And it's very, very been extremely stressful and very demoralizing for them. So what else I wanted to ask you is, I see that you were with Alaska Wildlife Troopers. That is correct, right?
No, ma'am. No. I'm sorry. I think that's probably Chief Waldron.
Oh, Chief Waldron. Okay.
I've been with KPD for 23
okay.
years.
Okay. Well, I'm still going to ask you the question. The question is, what role do you believe that you play in regards with bears? And because there's always somebody's tossing it to the next and the next and the next. And now we have to have someone, I think, come up from Kenai for Anchorage. It's absolutely ridiculous how they have the wildlife issues. It's a real hot button for me. So I just want to know, what do you believe the role is of a local police officer versus a trooper in regards to wildlife management? Because it's a huge issue in my community.
Well, in our community, it's a huge issue also. We have a huge black bear population. We closed our landfill back in 90, right after I got hired, 96, 97. And once they closed out the food products, then we now have trash bears. And we deal with it every summer. Last summer was a huge issue for us. We've tried to work closely with Fish and Game, Alaska Department of Fish and Game. We've also worked with the city owns the landfill here and all the trash collection. So we work with that department quite a bit, trying to get some of this under control. But it's a huge issue. The Alaska State Troopers, I know they're in the wildlife troopers, are doing enforcement issues, and they primarily don't do stuff in the city so much. They have helped out in the past if we've called them for certain issues. But it would be nice to have a collaborative attack on some of this stuff, because it's something that seems pretty insignificant when a bear gets into your trash, but it's definitely a quality of life issue when it gets into your neighbor's trash and drags into your yard, and then it starts neighborhood disputes and all, and then, yeah, it just kind of snowballs from there. So something as simple as a black bear getting into trash can be a huge, huge headache for us, and it's time-consuming. We do have an ordinance that we try to work with involving littering, but, again, that's a real tough one to do. You're trying to keep a 300-pound hungry animal out of a plastic box. And so, yeah, we have bear issues like you wouldn't believe. We try to work collaboratively with other departments and agencies to monitor it and do the best we can with keeping things secured and on the enforcement side of things. And unfortunately, we did have I would classify it as aggressive bear last year. We kept tabs on it. I reported it to the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. So they were in the loop on this too, and the troopers also. We need to keep monitoring and keep working at it, because it is an issue. I know it's all over the state, and the research I did, it looks like it's kind of becoming a nationwide problem. I saw it on the East Coast. I saw it in Canada and the West Coast. So I don't think Ketchikan's unique in any way, but it is an issue.
Can I ask?
Follow-up, Senator Rambo?
Okay, so basically, yeah, we get that it's an issue. That wasn't my question. My question was, what do you think your role is? But I'm going to say that I grew up in Anchorage. We never saw a bear, ever. My husband grew up on the foothills, you know, the Chugach Mountains, and there was never a bear. And there was trash in plastic bags at the end of our driveways every week. And so, to me, it's much more than just a trash issue. So I guess what I'm going to ask you is, will you consider public safety? Because I believe public safety is number one issue. And if you will help develop a plan in regards to, what are we supposed to do? I mean, in regards to, because everyone is tossing the football to somebody else when there's a bear, and nobody seems to really want to deal with it. So I'm asking, will you put public safety first and help clear communication in each of the communities for what help people in the population putting public safety first?
Absolutely. We've always put public safety first with the bears, and anytime we get a phone call or report, we respond to these bear calls nonstop through the summer. So, I mean, our first course of action is to try to educate people to secure their trash. Our second course is to try to educate the bears not to come back. And once they become what we would describe as a nuisance bear versus a public safety bear, then we try to get Alaska Department of Fish and Game involved to help us take care of these public safety bears, because we can't have them roaming our neighborhoods. Yes, absolutely. So if there was a group that was going to get together to try to push public safety more and figure out how to deal with some of these public safety bear issues, absolutely, I'd be on board with those dialogues.
Sir Machiggy?
Yeah, I don't have much to ask. I'm going to support Mr. White, and I'm impressed with his record. This is the Police Standards Council. My solution for bears in city limits is called a bow. But that's a different problem altogether. The question, I guess, to dovetail on that question, does the training currently from provided by the Alaska Police Standards Council involve the hazing, proper hazing and dispatching of wildlife? I mean, if you were here, Mr. White, you'd see a giant brown bear skull on my desk, and that was from a municipal police officer after we had a problem bear for a couple of weeks. And since brown bears don't go in my freezer, we ended up having to take that bear down. But it was by a trained municipal officer. Is that part of the training?
I don't believe that that's part of the standard academy training that our officers get, and that would be more of an in-house training. We do work, we qualify all of our officers on shotguns. Primarily, that's what we're going to be using on these bear calls. As far, most of you come from larger population areas, you understand that when we get these calls, we do have the problem bears. And when we do have a public safety bear, we sometimes do dispatch them, like you're talking about. But when we're in the upper avenues in Ketchikan, the houses are kind of packed on each other. So we do also rely on you know, some trapping issues to get them out of here. But we locally do train our officers with shotguns. We qualify them every year with shotguns to deal with those issues. We do implement the beanbags to start with, kind of like the progressive discipline we talked about. So we try to use the beanbags, the noise to scare them away first, and then if they become that much of a public safety issue, then yes, we will try to dispatch them if we get them in the right area. But again, it's city limits of Ketchikan kind of tough at times. And we have, and that's not, that's, you know, we don't like to have to do that, but yeah, it does come down to that from time to time.
Thanks, Chief. I think Senator Machiggy has a quick follow-up, and then I'd like to get to some actual qualification questions.
You've been serving since you've been serving for almost a year. Do you feel that you're being your participation is active and supportive of the Police Standards Council mission, and is why do you want to continue?
Why do I want to continue? I'm a true believer in this council. I think that the work they do is absolutely necessary. I know in my career I've seen, in the past we've had some issues where maybe our department didn't handle this the best way, and an officer was allowed to leave. And that officer went down south and became a problem officer for that department, and then he went to another department and became a problem officer there. And I think that kind of cemented, that was 15 years ago, and I think that kind of cemented in my brain that we need to do a better job of when people should not be in this profession, then they should not be in this profession in Alaska or in Washington or in Oregon or in Kansas or wherever they end up. And so the work that I've been part of, I've been very proud to be on this council, and I just, like I said, I truly feel like it's an absolute necessity for law enforcement in the state, not just for police, but for probation and corrections. And I feel like I have a great line of communication with the staff there. I can call Alaska Police Standards Council and talk to any one of them and get guidance for hiring new officers with background checks on new officers, lateral officers that come from other states that are really easy to work with. And so I feel like they're very receptive every time I've called to get guidance or help, and then they're there to support us with some of the questions we have and trying to get some of these people hired and making sure we're getting the right people in the position. So I really have enjoyed my, like I said, I believe I've done three meetings, a couple telephonic meetings, and and one in person. And I think it's
Chief.
They're big issues and they're hard, but I think it's really good.
Hey, Chief, we got to keep moving here because we've got seven to get through, and we've spent 25 minutes on the first one. So we're going to have to – I apologize, and I'm not trying to cut you off, but we do have to move a little faster on the answers to try to get to them all. That's okay. It's not that it's bad stuff. I just I got to keep this on track. So I've got a couple very pointed questions, if I could get a pointed answer from you. What are the requirements for APSC certification that a full-fledged police officer or a trooper would need for arrest powers? Can you put that on record?
Be 21 years of age, they have to have a high school diploma or equivalent, and then no domestic violence background. There's some drug qualifications too, and some other crimes that would preclude them. But the basic requirements are 21 years old and high school diploma or equivalent.
Copy that. Thank you. That's awesome. How would the inability to possess an APSC certification impact access to sensitive information, like an APSIN, if somebody's trying to run an investigation? What would that do to their ability to perform their job, or could they even?
To my knowledge, they probably could. I mean, we have civilians that have APSIN access, but it's the whole FBI background check, fingerprints, you have to be cleared. If you don't have that police background, then you wouldn't be able to get into that information, run those reports and make those complaints, make those cases, yeah.
Okay, and then a couple more pointed questions, and we'll probably get you out of the hot seat. Who signs off on APSC certifications, authorizing the credentials for arrest powers, and does that person have to be certified themselves? In other words, what qualifications does the authorizing person need to possess?
I believe the director signs off on the APSC certificates. When we hire an officer, we get them sworn in, and that gives them the authority to the arrest powers once we hire them and get them sworn in.
Okay, then one last question for you. And this is opinion, so I don't want to try to stretch it out a little bit here, but just your big picture. How does the council prevent itself from becoming, for lack of a better term, just a bunch of people that get together to discuss issues? What do you see as internal policies exist to keep the board above board and doing things the right way? How do you foresee that that's handled internally?
Internally, I think one of the biggest things is it's an open meeting. So people can call in, they can come in person, and they can see the council, they can testify in front of them, they can make comments to them. So I think that's imperative, that it's open to the public. The director does a great job of keeping the confidential stuff confidential, public stuff public, and once confidential is done, when it can get to the public, I think they do a great job of disseminating that information.
Awesome. That's a great answer, Chief. Thank you. Any follow-ups before we're going to close this one up? Okay, we're going to open up for public. Thank you, by the way, Chief, for coming on board and taking the time to call in. I know that sometimes you get a lot of weird questions that we're asking it to answer, so thanks for taking the time to call in. We're going to go ahead and clear you off, if you wouldn't mind staying on the line just in case, and we're going to open up for public testimony this time. I don't see anybody else that's called in specific to that. Is there anybody in the room that would like to testify at this time for the Chief? Okay, we're going to go ahead and close public testimony for Chief White. And at this time, thanks again, Chief, for coming on board and taking time today. We're going to roll on to the next one. Did Rebecca Hammond fall offline? What? Okay, well, I didn't know that. Give me the heads up. Okay, we're going to go then to Steve Dutra. We're going to keep with the Police Standards Council for now. So, Steve Dutra, do you hear us? All right, sir, if you would, please go ahead and give us your name and put yourself on the record and go ahead and provide your reasons for the being on and why you should be the guy on Police Standards Council, please.
My name is Steve Dutra, last name D-U-T-R-A. I'm a police chief in North Pole Police Department, and I have a lot to offer for the Police Standards Council. Obviously, I have over 23 years of experience. I've worked in rural Alaska and Department of Public Safety in Yakutat, and I've been on the Alaska Association Chiefs of Police for some time. I've been on the Standards Council since May. I've worked up through the ranks as a police officer, from line officer to sergeant to lieutenant, now chief of police. So I've got rural experience and small town North Pole. I mean, it's a little bit more urban than Yakutat. I have my bachelor's degree in criminal justice and communications, and I hold an instructor certificate in ethics. I taught at the TBC Academy in Ethics. I have a lot to offer as far as experience is concerned, and a pretty good grasp on what it takes to be a police officer and the standards that we require of those police officers. I've been doing this long enough as a chief that I think I have a pretty level head, and I can analyze the cases and that are brought before the council and make sure I give a good decision on behalf of the state of Alaska and the citizens. I've got two children. I've been married for over 15 years. I think that I'm a good fit for the council. I get along well with most of the chiefs around the state. I'm actively involved in the legislative issues and the issues affecting our city and our surrounding interior. So I think for those reasons, I'm a pretty good fit for the council.
Awesome. Thanks, Chief. I appreciate the intro into your resume and background. We're going to start with Senator Reinbold has a question.
So, Stephen, I'm not going to expect you to answer right now because I think you were online, but basically just putting public safety first, I think, is the most important thing, including wildlife. But my question to you is, your name is really familiar. Have you been part of the effort to putting victims first and shining light on some of the concerns of the criminal justice reform that has emboldened criminals?
Yeah, I was a loud voice in opposing SB 91. I was one of the only chiefs in the state that signed a letter opposing that, if that's what you're talking about.
Through the chair, yes, you were one of my few heroes back then, and I just really wanted to say thank you from the bottom of our heart, and many Alaskans say that. We heard your voice, and I hope you won't give up that fight.
Okay, I have a question for you here, Chief, and you're going to see for all three of you that are serving police officers kind of the same questions because I want to get these things on the record and your thoughts. But as you heard the questions, or you may have heard the questions asked of the previous interviewee, what are the requirements for APSC certification that a full-fledged police officer or trooper would need for arrest powers?
In order to become a police officer, you have to be a citizen, you have to be 21 years of age, moral character, you have to have a high school degree or a GED. Of course, I'm reading this off the Standards Council website, but basically, once you have the basic requirements, you get sworn in, and once you're sworn in, you then have the arrest authority.
Okay, and then if you were unable to get your APSC certification, how would that impact your ability to access sensitive information like APSIN if you were going to do investigations? What would that do to your ability?
It'd be very difficult. I mean, without having a background in criminal history and things that are on APSIN, it'd be very difficult to conduct investigations.
And you might have heard my last question to the previous caller. How do you believe the council is able to internally hold itself to a high standard and not, and I don't use the term loosely, say like a good old boys club, but how do you hold yourselves to that high standard because you're looking at the police work across the state? What do you envision as part of your role to ensure those standards are met and upheld within the council?
Well, first of all, it's a group of folks with impeccable credentials, and I can't imagine that any one person could influence that group. Based off what I've seen so far, there's stimulating conversation and stimulating debate about what is and what isn't ethical and moral. So I highly doubt that any one person could influence that group.
Questions so far? Yeah. One final question for you, Chief, because I appreciate the succinct answers. If you had somebody that I'll just ask it this way, just like I asked the previous caller. Who signs off on APSC certifications authorizing credentials for arrest powers, and does that person have to be certified themselves?
That would be the director or chief of police, and no, they do not.
Okay, thank you very much. Any further questions at this time? All right, Chief, again, thanks for coming on board. If you'd hold on for just a moment, I'm going to open and then close public testimony, and we'll see if there's any follow-up with you. This time, public testimony is open for Chief Dutra or anybody online. Nobody? Anybody in the room that would like to testify publicly? Okay, seeing none, public testimony is closed. Mr. Dutra, thanks for calling in today, and you're cleared out of the hot seat. Thanks for taking the time.
Thank you.
Who's the next one, Jake? Sir Burke. Okay, thank you. All right, get my act together. Oh, too much paper. This time we're switching over to Burke Waldron, Chief of Police out of Bethel for the Police Standards Council. Mr. Waldron, how do you hear us?
I hear you loud and clear.
All right, Chief, if you go ahead and put your, you know the drill, go ahead and put yourself on the record with your name and provide us the reasons for you to be on the council, please.
Yes, good afternoon. Again, my name is Burke Waldron. I'm currently the Chief of Police in Bethel, Alaska. I started my career with Alaska State Troopers in 1990. I had a 25-year career with the State Troopers in both divisions of the Alaska State Troopers and the division of what started with Fish and Wildlife Protection, then became the Alaska Wildlife Troopers. I worked up my through the ranks with the Department of Public Safety as field positions in both divisions, command level positions in both divisions, eventually retiring in 2015 as a detachment commander for the Alaska Wildlife Troopers. At that point in time, I took a couple of years off from law enforcement, enjoyed the outdoors, and did some gold mining and some big game guiding. And then in 2016, I returned to law enforcement and became the chief of police out here in Bethel. So through my career, obviously, I've had command staff level positions as well as field positions. I bring a both wildlife and your typical law enforcement. I've worked in rural settings and urban settings, and now I'm the chief in a rural police department. So I have a broad spectrum of experience that I bring to the council, which I think is very valuable to the council. I also strongly support the council and their efforts to keep the standards with officers at a high level, both morally and ethically, and experience and training wise, support their efforts in the past, and certainly support the efforts of the Standards Council in the future to continue doing that. Other than that, I don't really echo the sentiments of the two previous speakers.
All right, that's a great intro, Chief. Thank you. We're going to go open it up at this time for other committee members' questions. Senator Reinbold?
You know, this might seem unimportant, you know, with the police standards, but I just feel like there are no standards that are uniform right now with management of wildlife. And so I just really, really going to ask you, will you please work in regards to this so the police know what they're supposed to do rather than tossing it to this department, tossing it to that, and waiting for this and waiting for that. I mean, it's a pretty serious crisis when we have active bears, you know, living amongst us on our school grounds, on our trails, in our neighborhoods. We've had so many in Eagle River, it's not even funny. But just can you bring any light to that or any in a short sentence, or just make a commitment to please help solving this response, you know, this problem, and help in increasing education amongst our citizens to reduce dangerous encounters.
Through the chair, that's a very I do have quite a bit of experience with it. Actually, it's a complicated issue. You've got management of the wildlife that is the responsibility of the Department of Fish and Game, but the safety of the public, which is responsible of law enforcement in that current jurisdiction, and sometimes that public safety also bleeds over to the wildlife troopers. So potentially you have three different agencies that have significant management or significant responsibility for the public safety and the management of the wildlife, having to interact with one another to keep the public safe. So it can be very complicated. You know, I think overall throughout the years, at least in my experience, you know, all the agencies have done a good job in keeping the focus that the primary purpose or our primary responsibility is the protection of the people and the people's safety, you know, and take steps from there. I mean, certainly we don't want to you know, walk up and down the streets with high-powered rifles shooting every bear that we see. You know, that poses a danger to the public as well, obviously, as a danger to the bears. You know, hazing of the animals is, you know, sometimes successful, sometimes limited in success, and just the agencies need to work together to come to the best resolution possible.
Thanks, Chief. Senator Reinbold has a follow-up.
Okay, so I'm just going to ask for a yes or no, just because I know we have a lot of people to get through. Will you work with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game, get standards in place so that there's quick response to wildlife that are posing a dangerous to the public within the city limits? Yes or no?
Yes, certainly.
committee members at this time. Got a couple questions then. Chief, I know you asked, or you heard some, probably some of the other questions I was asking, so I've already gone through a few of those, so I'm going to get a couple other questions for you here as we go through the council, because you're looking at the standards we're upholding for LEOs across the state. So one of the questions I would ask in a slightly different vein, this, and I'm going to ask you the same one about how you would uphold the standards in the council, does financial credit, because I know we're talking a little bit about the moral and the criteria of somebody, who they are as you want to hire them as a police chief or into a department, does the financial credit, as you're looking at certification, impact whether somebody can be APSC certified?
I don't believe there's an APSC certification criteria for a an applicant's credit history. Is that what you're, if that's what you're asking?
In essence, yes.
Most agencies certainly look at applicants' credit history and consider that in their hiring decisions.
Yeah, I guess what I'm trying to get at, Chief, since I'm asking this in a different vein, since I asked it the previous two chiefs, is that what I'm trying to nail down is the exact criteria that permit a APSC certification, you know, for a trooper, especially for a trooper with your background. Of course, you're doing LEO duties as a chief now. So, you know, can anyone be certified if they meet the minimum qualifications, or is there a little more to it? Maybe that's a more pointed way to ask the question.
Well, obviously, the APSC, the qualifications to become certified as a police officer are in code, are in 13AC, and so those are the minimums that are required. Many agencies have higher standards. Some probably do not.
Okay. Thanks, Chief. I appreciate that. Anybody else have questions at this time? Okay. If you'd hold on for a minute, we're going to see if we have any public testimony, and then after that, we'll clear you off. Public testimony is now open for Chief Waldron. Do we have anybody online?
Nope.
Anybody in the room? Seeing none. Public testimony is closed. Chief, thanks for taking the time to call in today.
Thank you.
And I think, was it Rebecca? Was the last one? Okay. We're going to switch over this time to now Rebecca Hammond from King Salmon for, again, the Police Standards Council. Rebecca, how do you hear us?
Yes, I can hear you. Can you hear me all right?
Yes, ma'am. You're loud and clear. Go ahead and put yourself on the record with your name, and could you give us your reasons for being why you would like to be on and should serve on the Police Standards Council?
So hello, everyone. My name is Rebecca Hammond, spelled H-A-M-O-N. I'm not related to the Governor Hammond family. I reside out in Bristol Bay, Alaska, and I have actually served on this, on the Alaska Police Standards Council for two terms previous to this, so 8 years in total. I am a 20-year resident of Bush, Alaska, and my children have been born and raised there. I have worked as an advocate working with victims of domestic violence and sexual assault, as, you know, just one-on-one and also as a team member with law enforcement and other agencies. I've been working in that sort of role for about 12 years. And initially I was asked to be on this board to provide sort of that the input of from the public from a maybe a victim advocacy point of view. And coming onto this board, I really did not know what the Police Standards Council did at all. But the last 8 years have been very, very good and informative for me. And I've had a lot of experience working with law enforcement and seeing another point of view has helped me a lot in working as a team member with law enforcement. I believe that I bring a different kind of viewpoint to the council because of two things. One, because of living in a very rural community where opportunities are fairly limited, and often law enforcement is not something that people even have in their villages at all, at least not immediately available. And then also just not having any kind of police background and kind of giving the viewpoint of how maybe our communities view police officers. And one of my big goals has been that that our police members of our team could have a better reputation in our communities, and that there would be, we could restore some of that trust that may have been lost over the years. I'm very involved in my community and in a lot of different ways, and also in all the very small villages that are within hundreds of miles of where I work. I cover all of the villages that are served by the NACNIC District Court, so that is, I think, 18 villages. And when I'm working with people, I'm working with them in all sorts of ways, everything from obtaining and keeping employment to just basic safety, and working with Office of Children's Services, with the law, all different kinds of angles, working with the public. And so I feel like I'm a good fit to sort of express some of the public's concerns and needs when it comes to law enforcement. And with that, I'd be open to any questions.
First hand up. Senator Reinbold has a question.
Rebecca, first of all.
Actually, I'm sorry. Before I go there, just to make sure I don't forget, Senator Coghill has joined us. So, yeah. Senator Reinbold, go ahead.
Rebecca, thank you. I think you're obviously the public member, and I just think you're bringing some amazing training. You have over 10 years of focus and advocacy in regards to this. You appear to be very victims-focused. I know that Western Alaska has heart-wrenching statistics, and so I'm sure that there's things that you've noticed out in your community. And I just want you to know that there's people out here that are listening. If you feel like you're not being heard, I want to make sure that you know there are a lot of people in the legislature that want to help. And I'm going to ask if you would please reach out if you feel like there's strengthening of criminal code, if there's resources that you need, if there's red flags in an area where you think need to be addressed. I'm just going to ask you to continue to be a loud voice. Sounds like you're really interested in continuing that. And if there's anything you'd like to shed a light on right now and bring to our attention out there, especially in rural, in Dillingham, feel free to get it. You got a captive audience right now.
Rebecca, you still there? Uh-oh. We lost her? Well, that's going to make this a little more challenging. Let me know when she comes back, and we'll continue. So you might have to re-ask that question at some point.
I'll make it shorter.
You might have to, shorten the question up. So who do you want to run to next, Jake, now we have him in order? Frederick? Okay. We're going to go ahead and continue versus taking it out of ease just for time. We're going to switch over this time, and once we get Rebecca back online, we'll continue with that one. We're going to switch over now for Chief Administrative Law Judge appointee Kathleen Frederick in Anchorage. Kathleen, how do you hear us?
Yes, I can hear you.
Yes, ma'am, if you would go ahead and put yourself on the record with your name and give us your reasoning for wanting to be on this board and why you should be the one.
Okay, my name is Kathleen Frederick. I'm from Palmer, Alaska, and I'm seeking reappointment as the Chief Administrative Law Judge for the state. This would be my second term. And my background and experience is I've had over 30 years as an attorney in private practice, principally doing civil law, including administrative law. I'm AV rated by Martindale Hubbell, which is a national rating agency for lawyers, and that is the highest possible rating. I was managing partner of a small law firm for 9 years, which is directly germane to my job because OAH principally funds itself on its billings, just like a private law firm. I've been in state service since 2011, initially at the Office of Elder Fraud and Assistance, where I litigated cases statewide, and then I was appointed to the Chief Administrative Law Judge position by Governor Parnell in 2014. The Chief Administrative Law Judge has certain statutory duties outlined in our statute, AS 4464020, but principally those duties are supervising the Office of Administrative Hearings, which is an independent adjudicative agency housed under the Department of Administration, and it provides adjudication and mediation services for the executive branch of government. It is also authorized to provide those services for state related entities and for municipalities and school districts. I am goal-oriented and focused on cost savings and efficiencies, and some of the things that were accomplished during my first term was OAH is selected and installed a case management system, which allowed routine forms to be generated quickly and often by staff and move OAH into a paperless office mode. In addition, when I came on board, OAH had a substantial backlog of cases on the docket, and those were eliminated by 2017, and OAH, for the first time in its history since 2005, finished 2017 and 2018 without any overdue cases. In addition, OAH, over the past couple years, implemented a fast-track mediation program for Medicaid services cases, which resulted in a substantial savings to the state in both hearing costs and in reduced program costs. This program won a Denali Award for Cost Savings Initiatives in 2016. 83% of the cases, Medicaid services cases, resolve, that are sent to that program, resolve in a one-hour mediation conducted by a contract mediator, which is a fraction of the cost of what those cases would entail if they went to a hearing and to a decision. Most importantly, it has reduced the average time from case referral to case closure from 67.5 days to 36.2 days, meaning if services are unneeded, they're cut off a month earlier. And these Medicaid services cases and Medicaid audit cases, which are not part of the program, but the services cases, comprise about 40% of our docket. The other thing OAH has been doing, began doing, was offering adjudication mediation services to municipalities, state-related entities, and districts, which were authorized to do by statute. This is not subsidized by the state. They pay OAH's normal hourly rate, but they have benefited from reduced costs and our efficiencies and economies of scale. So those were some of the things I accomplished in the first term. I feel that I'm a good fit for this position because of my administration, civil litigation background, and private law firm management experience, which directly translates to this job. I've had 5 years of experience, so I'm definitely up to speed with the job and can hit the deck running. And I also feel I've done a good job over the past 5 years in increasing OAH's efficiency, as well as in recruiting talented and dedicated ALJs and staff. Many of the people who were on board when I first came to OAH had been with the entity since 2005, and pretty much all but two staff members have retired or been otherwise gone on to other things. So I've done a lot of recruitment with, I think, excellent people. I love my job as a chief ALJ. I find it both challenging and fulfilling, and I feel genuinely honored to serve in this position. I love the fact that when I get the annual surveys and the annual report to the legislature, one of the things people say about their OAH experience is it was positive, they were treated with respect. They may not have liked the decision, but they thought they were treated fairly, and they understood why the decision came out that way. And so I would like to continue to be able to do this work for the benefit of the state, and I have some vision for the future. Right now, Senate Bill 88, which is legislation introduced by Senator Michiki, is the culmination of a project that began back in 2014 to correct certain provisions in OAH's statute, which haven't withstood the test of time. And hopefully, once that's enacted, we would enact or we would promulgate regulations. The other thing I'd like to see happen, which I think could be a savings certainly to the municipalities, or rather the school districts, is in most states which have central panels like OAH, the special education cases are handled by that state's Office of Administrative Hearings. And here, two of the four hearing officers statewide for special ed cases are at OAH, with a third ALJ who has received special education training. OAH is also able to provide mediation services and special education services to school districts, services which are currently provided by an out-of-state mediator. So I would hope if I can continue that maybe I can work with the Department of Education so that that we could make this a reality. And finally, I believe additional efficiencies could be created by OAH becoming the final decision maker in some additional categories of cases, which would both reduce the adjudication time as well as increase the efficiencies. I just say in summary, it's been an honor to serve the state as the chief ALJ under Governors Parnell and Walker, and hopefully the legislature will confirm me again so I can continue in this capacity under Governor Dunleavy. So I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Betty? Start with Senator Reinbold.
First of all, Kathleen, thank you for serving. It's the first time I've ever thought of, like, oh, my goodness, you're kind of what we need as a mediator between the House, the governor, the Senate, the people, and the minority and the majority. It's like, oh, my goodness, this might be our ticket out of here. So anyway, thank you for what you do. I know you do difficult things. I just wanted to put on record that I think probably on behalf of all of us, the efficiencies that you found, the cost-saving reductions, you know, if there was only 100 more of you, I think the state would be in a whole lot better position. So just wanted to put on record, thank you, and I wish you well.
Thank you.
And I have a couple other questions. So could you explain what the process there is for citizens to get relief if they feel they've been had their appeals tied up for an unreasonable amount of time? Could be defined as whatever they decide, but what's the process for that?
So the process is normally agency makes a decision, and then the case gets appealed to the agency. The agency then sends those cases over to OAH. And refers those cases. It's supposed to be done within a week. That doesn't always happen, and sometimes we have to talk to the agencies about belated referrals. As soon as that case comes in, it's assigned to a judge and put on a schedule. Now, the cases, depending upon the type of case, they have different deadlines, anywhere from 20 days after the case is heard up to or after the case is referred up to 120 days. It depends on the type of case. And so our job is to get it on the calendar and have the case heard. Now, there are circumstances where, for the benefit of the parties, the cases are delayed at the request of the parties. They want to conduct additional discovery. There's a related proceeding and things like that. So they don't all get heard within that time period, but that's the overall goal, is to meet those deadlines, but they are able to request an extension of those deadlines if they feel it benefits them. Have I answered your question?
You did good. Thank you. A quick follow-up to that. Do you know what agencies do not allow their admin appeals to be handled by OAH?
Historically, there have been some, and they're supposed to ask for the permission of the Chief Administrative Law Judge to send it to outside hearing officers. There have been some cases in natural resources in the past 5 years since I've been there. Department of Transportation used to use outside hearing officers, but have been referring the cases to us since I came on board. Special education is one of the ones that is still Department of Education. They're referring them to a pool of four hearing officers, of which only two are at OAH, and there may be others.
And then a final question for you, and I'll see if there's another committee member. What's the typical cost for the agency by using OAH?
Well, it varies widely. There were some statistics done at the time OAH was created, and at the time the Department of Health and Human Services cases were merged into OAH. So it's going to vary. If a case is mediated, it's pretty cheap. I mean, our contract mediator is very reasonable. If it goes to decision, it depends on the complexity of the case. We have some cases that we hear in an hour-long hearing, and we have other cases that take a five-day hearing and the record is held open. But I think the average, last time I saw statistics, was about $1,300 per case. So that's the cheap ones averaged with expensive cases. The most expensive case we have had since I've been here involved a municipality that had an incredible record of 20,000 pages. And they actually thought our cost was cheap. But I think it was around $17,000. But that was an unusual case. Most of the cases we do very cheaply.
Thank you very much. Do we have other questions from the committee? All right. This time we're going to go ahead and open up public testimony. Do we have anybody online? Nope. Standard answer. Do we have anybody in the room that would like to testify? Seeing, hearing none, public testimony is closed. Kathleen, do we have any further commentary before we clear off? Kathleen, thank you for taking the time to call in this evening, and you're cleared out of the hot seat this time. Thank you. We're going to go back to Rebecca Hammond, see if she can hear us now. Rebecca, are you still with us?
Yes, I am.
All right, we'll continue where we fell off there. Senator Reinbold has a question that she's going to re-ask you. I think she's had time to make it even shorter because I think you probably missed most of it.
Yes, I never did hear anyone else speak. So after I finished speaking, I didn't hear anything else.
Yes, ma'am. Senator Reinbold is up.
Rebecca, we all know there's serious issues in rural Alaska, and especially in western Alaska. I was just amazed when I looked at the uniform crime statistics. Is there anything you'd like to shine a light on, any resource that you need? You got a captive audience right now. If anything that we should be aware of to help be more victim-oriented and help reduce the horrific things that we're seeing out in some of our rural communities?
So I guess I would like to highlight two different things. The first thing that we struggle with is that many of our most remote villages have no police presence at all. And in many of those places, they have also the worst weather you could imagine. So I can't tell you how many times I've been speaking with a victim on the phone and trying to safety plan with that victim with no police presence able to be there possibly in even 48 hours. Sometimes it's been 3 or 4 days. And so that really requires everyone to use a lot of creativity. And often we find that our victims are ostracized in their own villages for even speaking up about what's happening to them. And so one thing I would just really love to see is more people on the ground out in these places. And I have worked with some really high-quality VPSOs and VPOs, and I'd love to see more of our young people maybe moving into those roles and becoming protectors even information providers and support people in their own villages. If I even have one other person on the ground in the place where I'm talking to a victim, it is someone to work with and to strategize with. Sometimes I have much better success in keeping people safe. So that's one thing that I would love to see. I know it's not possible to have a trooper in every village, but when I hear about the VPSO program being decreased, it's very disheartening to me because some of those people are people I really depend on. Then the second thing I would say is just the way that cases are handled. A lot of times, the troopers or our local police and myself and other team members have worked tirelessly many, many hours supporting a victim trying to get help and to try to get justice, and then cases are dismissed or reduced down to very small charges, and then we see these people back in our villages very, very shortly, and then a lot of my time is spent just dealing with the fallout of what's happened in the family because of reporting or how to keep that person safe after the perpetrator has been gone for a very short time. So those two things I think are the biggest struggles that I have. And then just also, there just aren't very many resources available. For example, I have most of my clients struggle with substance abuse. And when I go to try to get a willing person into rehab, sometimes they'll say, well, we can get you a bed in 8 weeks or, something like that. So often we're just making do all the time with resources that in other places they would find completely unacceptable. So I hope that helps.
Rebecca, I have to say that I think that's two of the best answers in the 7 years I've been serving that I've ever heard. So I just want to say from the bottom of my heart, thank you. If you want to detail that out and send it to us in writing, I'd sure love to hear it. I have heard one too many heart-wrenching stories. And I think that, exposing what's going on in the communities, empowering the victims on what to do and helping bring justice, whether it's video teleconferencing or anything we can do. I know there's some bills in play right now. I just know that there's really eager listening ears, and I just want to thank you for your 10-plus years of helping victims. I think you're a saint.
Other questions?
You're welcome. Thank you.
Anyone? I would have to echo Senator Ramwell's comments. I think if we're going to get good answers, you have to be willing to ask hard questions, even if they're not popular. So thank you for being willing to do that. We're going to go ahead and open up public testimony at this time. Rebecca? Nobody? Okay. Is there anybody in the room that would like to publicly testify? Seeing and hearing none. Getting a lot of gavel hits today. Rebecca, thank you very much for taking the time to call in, and have a good evening. We're going to switch over this time to Rick Stille. Now he's from here for the Alaska Public Office Commission appointee from Delta Junction. Rick, can you hear us?
Yes, I can.
Rick, go ahead and put yourself on the record with your name and provide your testimony for why you would like to be on and should serve on the Alaska Public Offices Commission, please.
Sure. Okay. Thank you for the time that you guys are taking to listen to me. My name is Rick Stille from Delta Junction. I was appointed to the to a commissioner spot position on the Alaska Public Offices Commission, and this commission is an important commission, and I truly believe in the mission statement of the commission, and that is to encourage, first part of it is to encourage the public's confidence in their elected and appointed officials, and I believe that is paramount to a free society, that you can have the residents of the state of Alaska have complete confidence in transparency in their government. And this type of transparency, I believe, does start with election campaigns and appointments, et cetera, and then it carries on. I know that this position is more or less a volunteer position, and I'm willing to serve, and I believe that I have a lot to contribute to a cause I believe in. To go a little bit with my qualifications here, over the course of several years, I've worked on a federal installation and have worked on federal contracts as a contractor during that period of time from 2004 forward. So I see a lot of different regulations. More importantly, the regulations I'm familiar with are federal acquisition regulations, or otherwise known as the FAR, and Defense Federal Acquisition Regulations, otherwise known as DFAR. And if you haven't ever seen a desk reference to either one of those, there are several thousand pages of reading. I believe that, and I pretty much look at those on a daily, weekly basis, and make sure that our contracts, every area of my responsibility, is in compliance with the regulations that are spelled out in there. Just so that you all are aware of self-disclosure, I have been an active member of the Republican Party starting sometime in 2008, 2009 time period. In 2012, I was elected a District 9 chair, which District 9, as some of you know, encompasses a huge area with several communities. And I served in that position until 2016, at which time I did not run for chair again and took a position of assistant treasurer and held that position until I resigned at the beginning of this year when I was appointed commissioner. Also in 2016, I was appointed to the State Party Standing Rules Committee. And I served in that capacity as well until I resigned the first part of this year. And the reason I bring that up is on a much similar, smaller scale, of course, being on the state rules committee for the party, it was pretty much that committee's responsibility and assignment to look at the rules and advise the chair or executive committee on what the rules say whenever a complaint or an interpretation needed to be presented. And I believe that I operated in a fair and just manner, impartial to who was filing the complaint and who the complaints were filed against. And I believe that this commission, the expectation is very similar in an impartial manner. And, you know, I vow to do that. Lastly, as far as qualifications, and I think it's an important one, is that I have been familiar with APOC since 2012. I filed APOC reports for a district. I understand some of the challenges, particularly with the reporting, financial disclosures, et cetera, mainly for a group, and am familiar with the process. And, you know, presented accurate data to APOC with the exception of one or two minor things that were corrected. And why do I think that's important? For a couple reasons. First of all, I think knowing the challenges that a filer may face helps a little bit. And, you know, whether it be really related to deadlines or even the reportable data, you know, a first-time filer just getting into politics or being appointed to a position in government, obviously they don't have a lot of experience. Most of them don't have a lot of experience with this. They might not have a staff to help them, et cetera. And so they in addition to running a campaign or the such, they're faced with a learning curve on the ins and outs of APOC. And it can seem cumbersome when you're first starting out. But I think it's my personal feeling is it's important to get as many people involved from the community and not let the fear of filing wrong or reporting be a detriment to them seeking office. And, you know, I had the opportunity already to be in a APOC commission meeting and was extremely impressed by the staff there. They're very helpful. They can answer questions of anybody that has, or they can, you know, pretty much anybody that has any issues, they can take care of them. And I can remember going back, I have made a few phone calls to them as well, and they were very instrumental in helping me file accurate reports. So I think having this understanding as a commissioner is a plus, and having a little bit of experience filing your reports definitely helps as well. I'm honored and I'm thankful for this opportunity to serve and look forward to taking questions from this committee.
Okay, thank you, Rick, for your intro to your background bio and why you want to serve. We'll open up to the committee at this time for questions. Senator Kawasaki.
Thank you. Thank you for being online today. Just a quick question. Under Statute 15-1302 APOC, four members are selected by a majority vote. Under the description, there are two of each political party appointed by the governor receiving the highest votes in the most recent preceding general election at which the governor was elected, and those names, two appointees, are supposed to be chosen from a list of four names submitted by the central committee of each party. Were you one of those four that was submitted to the governor for consideration?
Yes, sir, as far as I'm aware.
So you were one of the four that was submitted by the Central Committee, the Republican State Central Committee, to fulfill this position?
Through the chair, Senator Kawasaki, I was not part of that process. I was called and said that I was a list of names that was being forwarded to the governor.
Okay.
Well,
No, not on that. Just another question.
Okay, Senator Kawasaki, another question. Go ahead, sir.
Thank you, and I appreciate you bringing up your history with the party, and that's good that you've done that and just brought that out. I did have a question about your activities with the party. As you mentioned earlier, in 15-1302 under APOC, a member of the commission may not, and then one of the items is be an officer of a political party, political committee, or group. Or participate in any way in any election, or participate or contribute to any political party. And you said that you have adhered to that. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Senator Kawasaki, yes, I have. I understand that I can no longer be a part of any campaign, be an officer of a political party, make any contributions and whatsoever in support of or against a candidate, as well as anything that appears on the ballot. And I can tell you this, my wife is delighted.
So, follow up, Senator Kawasaki.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just really quickly, The term of appointment, when we received this from the Senate Journal at the beginning of the year, says that you were appointed on January 16th, 2019. Is that correct?
Through the chair, I believe it was around that time period. I don't have the exact date in front of me.
Okay. So then the last question, or just another question I have, is that you filed a group registration on behalf of the District 9 Republican Party 3 days after that date. And I'm asking the question why that would be if you're a member serving in APOC, knowing that you may not be an officer of a political party, political committee, or group, or basically participate in any election campaign.
Through the chair, Senator, what I did was as soon as I found out that I was going to be appointed, I contacted APOC and to see how I can close out my involvement with APOC, since I'm the one that created the reports. And basically the District 9 members, the committee members of District 9, determined at that time that they were going to have the state party take care of all their financials and not do any more reporting in APOC. So on the guidance of APOC, I did close that out, and pretty much that was the end of any involvement at all with reporting or any party actions.
Okay. Thank you.
Good. Thanks. Senator Ramble, do you have a question?
Yeah, first of all, I want to say thank you for your willingness to serve. I think you guys have a really tough job, and I know that there's been some budget cuts in that area, so hopefully you guys can work efficiency. But with that, I just wanted to ask, it sounds like I'm really impressed with how you spoke and what you spoke about and how involved that you've been, including trying to understand the commission. What I want to say is if you get red flags, and sometimes people just don't have the courage to actually file a report, but if you hear red flags, I'm just going to ask, if you have the resources, please try to investigate it. And I'm going to ask you a yes or no if you're willing to help look at some sort of an anonymous reporting system, because a lot of times people don't want to report because it just becomes so doggone public, even though they know that there's real serious issues out there. So is that something that you think would have a possibility for you to be able to look into?
Through the chair, Senator Reinbold, I would be glad to look at that. I think a whistleblower type scenario is not a bad idea. That being said, I know right now that just from personal experience, the staff at APOC, while I know that they can be stretched at times, they will make every attempt to help anybody that does have questions or concerns about what the process is to file a complaint, et cetera. I would have to say, though, that the commission or the commissioners, their responsibility is definitely to follow the statutes that are already on the books, and any major changes to the statutes obviously is not necessarily in their scope. That being said, I could probably speak on behalf of most of the commissioners, would definitely be willing to help research and work with anybody that in the legislature that's wanting to look at some issues that you just described. I think that is a great idea.
Follow-up, Senator.
And I'm just going to put this on record, whether it's wise or not, I don't know. But I've had several opponents, and they were pretty amazing red flags going on. And I looked for people to, file complaints. I couldn't find anybody. We ended up having to do it ourselves, which was incredibly time-consuming and very difficult. And I can tell you, with all of us, we probably see – I don't want mandatory reporting necessarily, when we see, I know of things that are going on right now that I'd sure like to call and talk to, whether I want to go and follow and get my name on as a senator, highlighting some of the things that I'm seeing, if that's the wisest thing and the most appropriate thing. So I just think a pathway of anonymous reporting or bringing issues that can be investigated, I think are really, really important. And that's why every time I get someone with APOC, I try to ask this question. And I know resources are limited, but there's also, I think, just some really wise input, you know, and allowing people that bring things. It's hard to call you guys to bring things, to just know it's not falling on dead ears, and that there's possibly going to be, even if a formal report's not filed, that someone's listened and heard and may be able to do something about. So with that, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thanks. And Mr. Stille, again, thanks for coming on board today. I've just got a couple quick questions. Since you're looking at APOC, and obviously there's, you know, at times there will be allegations or incidents or, you know, backlogs, et cetera. So are you aware of any issues with APOC? And if you are, without necessarily having to go into detail, for just a brief answer, what ideas do you have for improvements with any issues you might see or think about APOC?
Well, you know, obviously, excuse me, Senator, obviously through just being appointed to this, I'm still kind of digging through the statutes and getting my feet wet, so to speak. One thing that I have noticed in the statutes already is just, you know, some references, and obviously we can't change the statute so much, but part of the statutes look like it's geared toward manning regional offices, and I'm not really aware of any other than probably the major areas. I think mainly due to the fact that at one time there wasn't necessarily the mechanism for electronic recording or electronic reports, the search, et cetera. And so I think there's just some real simple fixes to look at that might make it more efficient and remove some redundant or unnecessary statutes that are in there, bring them up to date, more current to where we are now. That being said, obviously, I'm not familiar with all the reasons that some of these statutes are in there, and I would definitely rely on our staff and our legal counsel to look at some of those, to maybe make recommendations to the legislature to see if any of these can be changed.
Okay, copy that. And, you know, efficiencies are always good. Accountability is even better. So especially when you're looking at something like this that reaches out, overreach, et cetera, of a government agency. So one of the things I would ask is that you continue to look not only for efficiencies to make it better, but assume that we have or assure us that you are looking for accountability, that we are doing it correctly. So I think that's one of your tasks as an agency that is looking at how elections happen and restoring or ensuring the trust of the public and how we conduct ourselves in that manner. And I believe Senator Ramble had another follow-up question.
Yes, and I'm going to go ahead and get my flashlight out. I was not planning on shining a light on this, but I'll just tell you one thing that I'm seeing in the Capitol this year. We've compared like 2017 to 18 to 19, and there are people that are lobbying apparently down here. It seems to be more than advocacy of 10 hours or less. And what you would do in a situation, I know that there's statutes, I know there's reporting issues, but it just makes me uncomfortable when I see numerous people down here from a broad range that appear to not be registered, and they're putting a whole lot more than 10 hours pushing legislation down here. It's very alarming to me this session. I see it worse this session than I've ever seen before. And so those are the kind of things that it takes a lot of time to sit there and document and say what's going on. But that's the kind of thing that I think somebody needs to be looking into, and hopefully we've got watchdogs down here. So, you know, that's just one thing I just want to go ahead and put on record that I think that APOC needs to be aware of right now.
Okay. Thank you, Senator Ramble. And I think we have one more follow-up from Senator Kawasaki.
Yeah, not a follow-up. Just a question. This is an important adjudicatory body. You do adjudicate the complaints and approve settlements and civil penalties and assessments in accordance with the law. So it's important that we have people on the commission that are that respect the laws and will dispatch them regardless of maybe personal feelings. I just have a couple questions. Just you have a Facebook account. You're fairly prolific in what you do and say, and that's free speech. It's protected. I recognize that. I just had a question. One posting on February 5th states that Islam never has propagated peace and love. One, a couple days later, says that while there might be peaceful Muslims, their religion is based on hate. And I just wanted to get you on the record as to whether you believe those to be true and factual.
Through the chair, Senator, I don't know how this is relevant. I do have some personal beliefs, and if I remember that post, it was from Reverend Franklin Graham, who just was the keynote speaker at the governor's prayer breakfast, if I'm not mistaken. And I want to say one thing about the person that I am, and that is that you're right. I do have the right for free speech. That being said, once appointed to this position, I have really quit all political postings, political commentary. I think it's just an ethical thing to do. And if you look back at my Facebook account, which you have, you will see that only a very small fraction of my Facebook posts are related to politics or anything of the such. And if you go back further, when I was involved in the party more as a chair or et cetera, most of my political postings were in defense of correcting what I believe was a mischaracterization of a person or a cause, and was not really an attack or being disrespectful or demeaning of anyone. That being said, I think that you can all agree that and I'm going to answer your question because that's who I am. I believe that there are many peace-loving Muslims. Not all of them fall into that category, but if you look across the globe right now, as Mr. Graham, Reverend Graham has kind of demonstrated, there is a movement to implement Sharia law, which really is not what any of us stand for in a lot of their viewpoints with the way that they treat women and such. So I'm going to just say that for the record, and I'm not afraid to say that. That being said, I will not make any, as related to APOC, I will not make any decisions based on any of my viewpoints or disagreements with anyone. I believe in respect. I believe in listening to different opinions, and all decisions made by me on this commission will remain within the confines of the current statutes or regulations, and it's not based on my personal beliefs or opinions. It's all strictly by looking at the statutes and analyzing the situation and coming up with a solution. So I appreciate your question, and I hope that you take my answer at face value.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
All right. Thank you, Senator Kosakian. Thank you, Mr. Stiller, for taking the time to answer that. As you said, we all have the right to free speech, but it is important to put on the record that you know how to separate your opinions from your ability to do your job, follow the laws as they are written, because we all have to do that even when we have personal disagreements with that, or else we are a nation of anarchy and we can't go there. That being said, we're going to go ahead and open up public testimony. This time doesn't look like there's further questions, so public testimony is open, just to verify nothing. Anybody that we do have one. You want to testify, Vicky Joe? We have a public testimony for Mr. Stilling. Yes, ma'am. I don't see you on there, but that's okay.
Are you disappearing? Eat just a message.
Oh, that was not handed to me. That would be why. It's okay. Vicky Joe, you know the drill. Please put yourself on the record. And I'm going to ask you to limit to 1 minute if you could, just because our time is short and we still have one more to go. When you're ready, ma'am.
60 seconds.
Yes, ma'am. 60 seconds or less, please.
Vicky Joe Kennedy, Kodiak Island, Alaska. How's that? Well, I am totally upset with Mr. Stilley because, number one, he wasn't even here 2 weeks ago when we vetted the rest of them. He wasn't on the phone. He didn't show up. He wasn't here. And nobody could find him. And I think there's problems with him. And what I just heard just now makes me really think there's problems. And he's an awful busy man. He's babysitting a nest of silos up at Fort Greeley. So I don't think he has a lot of time to be playing around with Public Utilities Commission or anything else. But I do have some serious problems with him, especially some of the things that were just said. And he was, I guess, took office the 16th of January, and that posting was on February the 5th or something. I don't think the man's trustworthy, and that's just my personal feelings, and I think I'm entitled to that. But I think he's way too busy, and I'm even worried now at the point with him sitting on silos and babysitting a nest. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Vicki Joe, for taking the time to come up and testify this afternoon. Are there anyone else? Is there anyone else for Proper English in the room that would like to testify? Seeing and hearing none, I'm going to go ahead and close public testimony this time. Thank you, Mr. Stille, for calling in this afternoon. We're going to switch over to last but not least, strictly because it was the last phone call to show up, so I put you at the bottom of the list. And I'm going to ask the indulgence, because we have a few minutes left since she is here, if the committee is okay to stay for a few extra minutes. And we've got Edie Grumwald on the line to finish for AK Parole Board appointee calling in from, wow, Maryland. I suppose she's not in the state. Edie, do you hear us?
Yes, coming in loud and clear.
Awesome. You're a little bit scratchy, so I'll let you know if the video or the audio quality goes down. Could you go ahead, you know the drill, go ahead and put yourself on the record, and could you please give us your testimony for why you should be on the parole board?
Well, my name is Edith Grunwald, and I think I'd be a good fit on the parole board. I bring a lot of qualities, make a good team member, good leadership. 31 years military, most of it is as an officer in the Alaska Air National Guard, and any parole authority member, you know, it demands competencies in shaping and leading complex organizations, and the parole authority is not large, but it's definitely complex, and my appointment started March 1st, and I started training on my own ahead of that, attending hearings and being an observer and digging in the into the statutes and the codes. And I got drug into the justice system about 27 months ago. I'm sure everybody's aware with my son's case. And even though the parole board wasn't on my radar at all, the more I thought about it and the more I researched on it and processed it, I think that I would be a good fit on it. I have effective interviewing skills that's required for the position. I'm conducting hearings as the director of human resources, but also in my entire career, I've conducted lots of interviewing and counseling, and it's very important to be a motivating factor for the parolees. I think I can further the purpose of the parole board. I have two master's degrees, and one's in national strategy, but it also incorporates a lot of government and strategic policies, and the other one's in a business admin type, and occupational technology is my bachelor's degree. Started out as an aircraft machinist, so I understand the need for the trades, and I understand the need for inmates to have a trade, have sellable skill sets, and I like the connection, and I could be a conduit. It's important to have partnerships with the state and the community. Even the parole board has to have good networking and be collaborative with public safety, corrections, and a lot of the services that need to be provided to the inmates as they get their programming prior to release and after release to help them be successful, because with our inmates coming out and being successful in our community, it provides the public safety that we all need, and it of course, reduces the financial demand that right now with the high cost of with all of the crime that's going on. I think that there's a lot to be done, and I think I would make a good addition to be a part of what's to happen in the future.
Thank you, Edie, for taking the time to intro yourself to the committee. Senator Reinbold has a question.
So, Edie, thank you for your willingness to serve. I know you've been on a tough journey. I've been through bits of the journey with you. You have just really been an amazing example in helping bring justice to victims. You also, with your statements, it's really heartwarming to know you want even the defendants to get a good trade and something to keep themselves busy and feel good about themselves. So because I know we're running over time now, I just really wanted to say thank you for your advocacy, in particular for victims' justice as well as criminal justice. And I just wanted to say thank you for your willingness to serve in this role.
Thank you.
Senator Coghill.
I just wanted to add that thanks for your service to our country as well and to our state. Edie, the one thing that will come up eventually is the heartbreak that you've had to go through and your entrance into the justice system. It sounds like your focus has been on accountability, but you're going to bring your top leadership skill to the table. But man, oh man, it looks like it'd be awful difficult for you emotionally. So how have you kind of prepared yourself for this particular portion? Because I think you're going to be good at it, but I just want to hear from you on how you think you have to prepare for this.
Thanks, Senator Coghill. I appreciate that question, and it's an extremely valid question. There's moments where it is challenging for me, and but I'm very objective, and I want, I think there's programs that are available for people that, commit some of the heinous crimes. And on my training expedition for the past 3 days, I've made sure that I've hit a lot of the juvenile type breakouts as well as victim breakouts. And so it's very challenging, but it's also very, I think that I have the capacity and the resiliency just because of my past experiences and just getting, I just got to get some good done out of all this. And maybe I can provide some type of balance between this whole victim and offender struggle that's going on, especially since right now it looks like on the national scale the victims' rights are trying to and are taking hold and becoming more understandable, and the sky's not falling when you include the victims. And then the same things with the offender, and that's what the parole authority can do, and sitting there while we're interviewing is it gives them a chance to speak and say their mind and gives them a chance to look at their plan, but it's going to be a challenge. I'm not going to make light of it. I appreciate that you acknowledge that, but at the same time, I think it's good for me, and I think it'll be good. Maybe I can add even more to where we want to go as a state.
Thanks, Edie. Senator Coghill has a follow up.
I just want to say thank you, and we'll do our best to back you up wherever we can, and thank you for being willing to serve here.
Thank you. Senator Kawasaki, any other question?
Thank you. Yes, just a couple questions. Thank you, Edie, for being here. Thank you for running and bringing some sort of an insurgent sort of campaign to the Lieutenant Governor race. It was interesting following you, and I've appreciated our discussions together. So part of the parole board, the selection criteria for board members, I've read quotes and stuff from you in the paper. One of the things, though, that it says is that the governor shall appoint board members on the basis of their qualifications to make decisions that are compatible with the welfare of the community and individual offenders. The governor shall appoint members who are able to consider the character and background of offenders and the circumstances under which offenses were committed. I've read your quotes, and they're great. Can you tell me, just sort of following up with Senator Coghill's questions, do you feel that you're able to do that?
Actually, it's one of my favorite things to do. I love interviewing. I've always loved interviewing. I love hearing what people have to say, their stories, considering it. And
I think you've got some professional and very experienced people on the board, and they've been extremely gracious, and I've been learning lots. And I'm objective, but I'm also understanding, and I don't want people to re-offend because I don't want there to be any more victims. So I understand the purpose in all of this, and I hope to be able to add to finding the resources and connecting the dots. That's another thing that I do really well is connect the dots to hopefully get things to work a lot smoother. So I hope to bring I think that's probably going to be one of the easier parts right there, just because of my experience, and that's just one of those things that on the scale of learning of competencies that I have.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Kosak's follow-up.
Mr. Chair, just another question, and we can even talk offline about this, but another duty besides your adjudicatory duties for parolees is to, under duties of the board, 3316060, is to recommend to the governor and the legislature changes in the law administered by the board, and recommend to the governor or the commissioner changes in practices of the department and other departments of the executive branch necessary to facilitate the purposes and practices of parole. My question to you is whether you've thought about recommendations that you would make to this legislature or the governor or the commissioner which would enhance the parole board's efficiency and efficacy.
Well, I think at this point I am not really at that juncture to do that, but I can say after listening to several states here at some of their practices and what they do, I think they've got kind of an efficient practice there in Alaska. The one thing that does bother me, and I'm going to be paying attention to, is listening to what's going on. It seems like before the changes in the parole board or the parole practices with SB 91, the board members had to justify why they would let somebody out. And now they have to justify why they keep them in. And I think that's backwards. Because when the person comes to meet the board, they're expressing everything that they've done to prepare and what their plan is to be successful, and the board can add to that. But when they come and already expect that for discretionary parole that it's time to get out, and it doesn't happen, I think it might cause some conflict. But at this point, I don't have anything official that I can bring to you, but I look forward to being in that role where I'll be better educated and informed to do that, though.
Thank you. Through the chair, the parole board will definitely be elevated if legislation that we're working on right now passes, and because you'll also be in charge of the pretrial folks in probation and parole. So it's an elevated position, and I certainly hope that we can work together on improving some of the processes. So thank you very much.
Okay. Well,
thank you. And Edie, Senator Macecki also had a question for you.
Yeah, actually, Edie, I don't have a question. I appreciate all of your service to our country, and I have followed you over the last couple of years, and although you're a parent in mourning, I have found your responses to be reasonable and credible and probably less hysterical than mine would be. So although I'm sure you have your moments, I think with that kind of tension in your life to remain that centered, I think you're a great fit for the board. So thanks for putting your name in, committing to 5 years, State Board of Parole. Thanks.
No, and believe me, I understand commitment after 31 years in the military.
Edie, you already know what I think. I've known you and Ben for a very long time, so I don't have to reiterate my stance in supporting both of you, and not only what you're going through, are going through, but your willingness to step up and continue to serve for both of you. I know it's tough, but it is much appreciated. We actually have, if you would stay on the line here, Edie, a couple public testifiers just in case at the end. And we're going to start with, I think we have one in the room, correct? We have Roger Branson, if you would come on forward, please put yourself on the record. I'm going to ask, because we're so late, if everybody would just testify for 1 minute. So it is kind of quick, but please keep your remarks to 1 minute. And when you're ready, go ahead and begin with your name.
Thank you, Chair Schauer. And for the record, I came prepared for 2 minutes. I rehearsed it at that. I am going to do my college best.
Minute and a half. I gave you that.
If we cannot see the injustice in the small things, we should expect to be blind to the injustice in the large things. On the day that David Grunwald was murdered, we, the people of Alaska, lost 6 young people. Of that specific group of 6 human beings, Mr. Grunwald, as a Christian, I would argue, was the most fortunate. But only those who believe we serve a loving God who is also merciful will be able to grasp that reality. It was we as a culture, but more than that, as a state, that let these 6 young men down. We let them down by not having age-appropriate activities available to them, the kind of activities my house in Wasilla provides for young people, but they're on the other side of the valley. David Grunwald could have been Palmer's Kirby Krause, but such was not to be, and he has now gone on to whatever is next for him. We should be happy for David Grunwald. Of the 5 left behind from that group, we should allow them the same opportunity we afforded Israel Keyes and allow them to end their lives on their own accord without the debacle of public shaming. This act of mercy would save the state around $50,000 annually per willing respondent. I am confident that if we ask my house if that same 50 grand could be used to save 6 otherwise lost souls, they would say yes, and I am confident they would be factually correct. For the sake of Mrs. Grunwald and the Grunwald family, I ask you to allow them the space to heal, the ability to someday find room in their hearts for forgiveness, and not to be burdened by being placed in a position of forever seeking retribution for what could have been. Please do not confirm Eddie Grunwald to this position. Thank you.
Thank you for taking the time to testify this afternoon. We're going to switch offline at this time to Carolyn Porter and Palmer. Carolyn, how do you hear us?
I can hear you just fine. Thank you for taking my call. I'm Carolyn Porter from Palmer. I am calling in support of this nomination. I've known Eddie Grunwald for quite a while. I know her to be honorable, respectful. She's very ethical. She's intelligent, and she is one of the most fair people I have ever known. Eddie will be able to approach this position with the fairness that you would expect from anyone else, taking her personal issues, and if she puts them in at all, it will be to make a positive impact. She's not afraid of hard work. She's willing to do what's required to prepare for any position given to her. Edie, as long as I have known her, has always put forth all of her energy and all of her efforts to do the very best work she can possibly do. I can't imagine you not confirming her for this position. And I thank you so much for listening to me.
Thank you very much for taking the time, Carolyn, to call in this evening. Edie, are you still with us?
Yes, I am.
Just because we actually had public testimony, usually we give everybody just one brief wrap-up if they'd like to. So I'm going to give you just a few seconds if you have anything to say. If you don't, that's fine, and you can check off. I'll leave it up to you.
No, I'm good. Thank you.
All right, Edie. Again, thanks for taking the time to call in from Maryland. Have a safe trip. And I apologize. I've got to close public testimony since I hope I opened it from what I remember. Probably get it right. But it is closed now, so we'll say that there. Thanks for calling in. At this time, that was our last governor appointee to boards and commissions. Just as a reminder, for anyone online that did not get a chance to put in testimony, you can always submit in writing to senate.state.affairs@akleg.gov. We'll make sure it gets in the public record. At this time, we're going to read the committee, the official report. Senate Appointee Committee Report dated 4/02/19. In accordance with AS 3905080, the State Affairs Committee reviewed the following and recommends the appointments be forwarded to a joint session for consideration. Alaska Police Standards Council. Stephen Dutra, Burke Waldron, Rebecca Hammond, Joseph White. Chief Administrative Law Judge, Kathleen Frederick. Alaska Public Offices Commission, Rick Stilley. Alaska Parole Board, Edie Grunwald. This does not reflect an intent by any of the members to vote for or against the confirmation of the individual during any further sessions. I would remind the committee after we gavel out to stay around to sign the record, please. This concludes our business for today. Senate State Affairs will be meeting again this Thursday, April 4, 2019, back in this room, 1:30 p.m., back to the nice long marathon session, just FYI. And we'll get an initial rollout of three bills. We have, and I forgot the name of one, we didn't write it down, but I'll be announcing that tomorrow on the floor. We have SB 78, established May 31st as Katie John Day, SB 92, contributions to the general fund. And then later on, after we add the third one, which I'll announce on the floor tomorrow, SB 32, crime, sentencing, mental illness, and evidence. We'll get started on our last hard lift, I think, of this one for the crime bill. Seeing no other business before the committee, we'll adjourn. Let the record reflect the time is 5:18 p.m. And thank you guys for sticking around to get those done. That helps.